Welcome to the AI Lyceum, where we explore ideas, people, and technologies shaping the future of intelligence. I'm Samraj Matharu, certified AI ethicist from Oxethica, based on a course from Oxford University. And I'm also a visiting lecturer for AI marketing at Durham University. In each episode, we speak with leaders driving real innovation in AI with no hype and real insight. So today, I'm joined by Peter Gostev, who's head of AI at Moonpig. He leads generative AI initiatives across the entire business. He's got over 61,000 followers on LinkedIn. He's widely recognized for going through AI hype and translating complex technologies like this into simple and practical LinkedIn articles and thought leadership posts. So before Moonpig, he helped to define the AI strategy in NatWest Group, which is a bank, to build scalable solutions and empowers or his team, should I say, to use AI confidently. So I'll pass over to Peter to introduce himself in further detail.
Hi, Samraj. Thank you for having me. Excited to be here. And thank you for the introduction. It's kind of to make it maybe put it into more practical words. My day job is to bring AI into Moonpig, and it's everything from building customer-facing features to helping our teams use AI better, which could be just using the tools, or introducing maybe some new workflows tools that are enabled behind the scenes. And then in the evenings, I do the extra things that don't necessarily fit the day job, but also interest me around AI.
I've been following you for a while, and a lot of the posts that you make are really simple to understand, like comparing how different models are generating answers using, you know, moving objects and things like that. So really unique way of doing it. And recently you went to the OpenAI Dev Day. So can you explain a bit more how that Dev Day works and what you learned from it?
Yeah, so Dev Day is really awesome event, and it kind of does, I guess it's like, obviously it's by OpenAI, so everything is about OpenAI, but the coolest thing is really it's like a bit of a celebration of just AI and like everything that's happening in that space. And it's my first time in San Francisco, so that was doubly exciting. But the whole thing is basically you get the whole day of, I don't know how many thousands of people there were. Everyone's interested in AI. Everyone's on the same wavelength. Anyone you can just strike up conversation with, and you know, they all talking about all the latest things they've been trying out and what works, what doesn't work. So that's been really, really cool. And just to see the feel, the excitement of people in the industry. Because I think if you go to general conferences, like in the UK, or I'm sure somewhere else as well, there's always like quite a big variance of people who I know haven't even tried doing anything, or some people who just read about it, others like really deep into it. And it takes you a bit longer to kind of get on the same wavelength with people. But somewhere like that where you just got a concentration of all the AI kind of first people, then it's very different. So that's the, just the general kind of vibe of the event, big positive excitement. And beyond that, OpenAI did an amazing job organizing the event, and there were great talks, but actually you can find all of them on YouTube, so you haven't like particularly missed out or anything like that. It was really cool to meet in person a few people, like Greg Brockman, I had a quick chat with, like Mark Chen, the chief scientist, a few other people like who work on Sora and Codex, and the various other teams. That was really cool as well.
And what was your favorite conversation based on the day?
Yeah, the definitely quite a few. I think conversations with the Sora team were quite interesting, and there was a lot of it kind of coincided with all the hype around Sora, so that was really like high on top of the minds of a lot of people. There are things like, for example, now you can only do 10-second videos or like 15-second videos, I think, if you do the right settings. But there's no reason why they couldn't do 1-minute videos. They're just like GPU constrained. So that's not really a big constraint. They know a bunch of other things, start frame, end frame. So there are things like that they can add as well. So it does feel like it's kind of just the beginning on that front. Another one was Codex. Really feels like it's the beginning of them just taking it really seriously. So they have apparently 100 people working on Codex product, and they've got the CLI, the terminal tool. They've got the web one where you can kind of go off in the background to work on that. And yeah, I think they're gonna connect different pieces up quite a bit more. And you can really see, I think, with Codex that, like, the big powerful thing, and to be fair, also Cloud Code was the first one that really started that wave, and Codex kind of picked that up as well. So I think credit definitely goes to Anthropic on that one to start with, and a bunch of other, like Google has a one as well. But the powerful thing there is that can really just you can use everything on your computer, so you can pick up the files, you can run Python or whatever else needed on your laptop, and then create files and can do clone repos and do a bunch of different things that is quite a bit of friction if you're doing anything else. So I really moved away and changed my workflow quite a bit, where I used to do stuff in ChatGPT quite a lot. Now it just feels quite constraining to do things in ChatGPT, so you just move it out and do it on a desktop. It feels a lot more powerful.
And if you were to advise somebody trying to use AI for the first time, what tools and what sort of workflows do you recommend to them?
Yeah, well, I'll say keeping it simple for yourself is probably a good idea. So in terms of tools, to be honest, most of the tools in terms of the main labs, they're pretty good now. So I would say whatever you've got access to at work, that's probably the best one you can have. So yeah, if your work uses Gemini, just use that. Yeah, if you've got ChatGPT, just use that. I think the reason why I would gravitate towards ChatGPT is that it's the one that vast majority of the people use. So they've got 800 million users now and so on. So there's a little bit more infrastructure, there's a bit more momentum, and you can kind of be sure that someone else is probably using it. So there's a bit more gravity around it. So that probably makes sense. But equally, you know, if, I don't know, your people around you use Claude, just use Claude, that's fine as well. So and the most important thing I would say is just worth really trying and using it, because when listening to our conversation is good, but it's not a substitute for trying things out. You can't read about this, really. It's a kind of thing that no one has the intuition for. There's no way you can have an intuition for speaking to some alien brain and what works, what doesn't work. So it's really worth just putting some time in, and there's no way around that.
Yeah, I certainly agree. I've been using a lot of these tools for a while, and Nano Banana is one that I like. I want to use Sora, but I don't use a VPN, so I need to wait for it. I've been using Sora, the first Sora. So by Sora, I mean saying I can't use Sora, I mean Sora 2 in the UK at the moment. But I use Sora when I like it. I think it's really good. It's, for me, I like it to have longer videos. At the moment, it's producing really short videos, but I'm sure in the next year or two, it'll have really long videos, and it'll get to a point where we have, you know, 30-minute long videos and people can make their own films and that sort of thing. Which brings me to my next point. AI is becoming agentic, and a lot of people, including myself, struggle to understand the difference between an agent and agentic. Would you be able to define the difference between those two for me, please?
Yeah, sure. And look, I think whatever I'm going to say is not definitive, and it does vary depending on who you're speaking to. I would say from my perspective, there is a meaningful difference in one way. So a lot of the time when you hear the word agent, what we really are saying is that there are different LLM steps, and some maybe not LLM steps, but different steps which are kind of stitched together. So it's much more of a workflow. And to be honest, what, for example, OpenAI have launched like a agent builder. It's not really an agent. It is kind of a workflow that you can say, and just to make it really clear, what I mean by workflow, and in this case, many people call it agent, is you can take one step that, I don't know, interprets the text. Maybe the next step is you hand it off to another step, which, I don't know, analyzes it, triages it, and puts it into another queue, and so on. This is the kind of thing that most people have been building, and they quite often call it agent just because it sounds better, but in practice, it's a workflow. And when it comes to agents kind of being more agentic and being more, for me, agent is the kind of synonymous with productivity and making more autonomous decisions. Then we are kind of going away from that one workflow where you always do it in a certain way. So one example, which is a really good one, are agents such as like Deep Research that was from OpenAI, or they also have like an agent mode that I don't think too many people have tried. And the reason why these are really much more of an agent than a workflow is that it's not predetermined which path is going to go down. So, for example, especially if you try agent mode, which is literally like it opens up websites, it clicks around and so on, it's not predetermined that, oh, it should use Wikipedia first and then go on this link and do this. It can do a search first and can pull up some websites. It then reacts to what's on the page and then can run some Python script or can download things and run things in the terminal and so on. So it's much more trying to reach a goal. I think you use a range of different tools to reach that goal. And this is much more rare. There are really very few actual agents that can have a suite of tools that it can interchangeably use. And the reason for this is that it's really quite tricky, A, to find use cases where it's genuinely better than building a workflow. And second is it's quite expensive and also not very reliable. If you look at what OpenAI have been doing, which I think is a pretty telling example, is whenever they had true agents, they have also always fine-tuned the model to be that particularly good at that task. Now, I'm not saying it will be the case forever, but for example, for the agent mode in ChatGPT, that's a fine-tuned model of, I think, O3, maybe, not sure if they've upgraded it or not, the GPT-5, but that was the original model that they used. So they had to fine-tune it. So it's much more complicated or much less reliable for you and me to go to the agent mode to be like, oh, yes, let's build an agent and it can do all of these things. Chances are it probably couldn't. So I will kind of split it in two. So one is workflows where you have defined specific steps and your AI system kind of goes from one step to the next to the next. Or you have an agent which can go any different ways depending on the on kind of how it's progressing with the task. And then it can switch between different tools to achieve that task. Now the second one is the probably the one that people kind of imply, but they're actually in practice probably doing the first thing.
I feel like there's going to be a lot of walled gardens where people will use just an OpenAI suite or a Google suite and a lot less cross-platform integration, because I've seen in OpenAI now they have, you know, the ability to access all my documents in the share drive. Google Docs, Google's done the same with Google Docs, etc. So I see them being walled gardens. And in terms of agentic AI, what do you see is the most, what's the biggest wow factor actually generally in AI that you've seen? What made you take a pause and say, this is amazing?
Yeah, I feel like that sort of moment happens like every few weeks or months, depending on your level of enthusiasm. But yeah, just like going over the last few months, going backwards, like Sora was definitely a big moment where it was genuinely quite unexpected. I would say my take on it that the big difference with Sora versus any other models, like even VO3. So VO3 kind of core quality is not much worse than Sora, like it's pretty equivalent, and the sound is good and so on. But with VO3, if you give it a general kind of prompt, like make a funny clip with this character, it's just probably gonna come up with some nonsense. It's not really that interesting. But with Sora, they really craft these really tight clips that are actually fun to share, and they're actually quite funny. So they clearly like tune the system to produce these videos in such a way. So I kind of called it as a more of a narrative model. So it's really combining those few things to really make it a compelling end product. So that was surprising, because you kind of think about what's surprising quite often is when you discover new dimensions that people going down. Because before it was like, oh, can the model do the gymnastics? So that everyone was pushing down that direction. And then models kind of solve that and be like, oh, okay, I guess we kind of pretty much solved that. That's good enough. And then some other lab takes another turn and goes in another direction. So that was quite interesting. The one before was, you mentioned Nano Banana and the Google model. That was quite impressive as well. And the reason why it was impressive is that it was the editing capability was far more precise than what we had before. The ChatGPT model was very good, but it was like quite slow and it didn't retain like facial identity very well. So there were like few issues with it that was great for style transfer. But sorry, so do you remember the cartoonification of you know, that was going viral, but editing wasn't that good. So now the Nano Banana model introduced that editing capability, which we haven't really seen before. It's still quite flaky, so I think there's quite a lot more to do, but that was definitely a big shift. Then going earlier, maybe what is a month or two before that, for me, GPT-5 Pro was a big uplift in terms of the capabilities we had. So, and especially the Pro version, the GPT-5 thinking AI models were very good, but it's they were kind of not such a big shift from, for example, 03, but GPT-5 Pro really feels like a really solid model, or kind of maybe it's more of a system that can search really well, that can produce things which are really coherent, they're really good at coding and so on. So they feel like really, really solid models. So that's what three things which like quite different from one another, I don't know, 3 months or something like that. And you know, you can keep going backwards in terms of what are more impressive things. And kind of in between that, I should say Codex, and before that was Cloud Code, where it really shifted the way these models, you can consume these models, that feel really different and kind of show the direction where it can go. So I would say what's really underappreciated, I think, although people kind of do see that there's a big rate of change, but what I think is underappreciated is the kind of the dimensionality of the changes. It's not just like, oh, the model is a bit bigger and is a bit better and kind of what else is new, and you kind of get bored of that. But it's the fact that we've got new UIs and ways of interacting with these models. So that's Codex. So we've got new capabilities of image models with Nano Banana, new capabilities of video models with Sora 2. Yeah, and just the core performances, I feel like, is pretty insane with GPT-5 Pro models. So when people kind of claim, you kind of hear this narrative sometimes of, oh, it's all... we don't see as much progress anymore. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe if you take a certain perspective, a certain kind of dimension, you look at it, okay, maybe it's not that different. But you go back a few months, I'm sure I've missed a bunch of things. You can get, there's so much that we can talk about.
Yeah, it's so hard to keep up with it. And I just wonder how you keep up with it, to be honest. So how do you keep up with it on a day-to-day basis?
I just read all the time. Read everything, and you can't try everything, but you need to make sure you try things, and you need to kind of try to work out what you feel like is meaningfully different. So there's probably a rule of thumb, you know, should try everything from Anthropic, Google, and OpenAI. That's probably a kind of a no-brainer. Sure. So those three companies, you should keep an eye and see what they release and try everything, what they do. Or, you know, maybe it's a small research thing, maybe you don't have to, but it is the big releases like Sonnet 4.5, like you should try that really and see what it feels like. Gemini 3 could come out soon, you know, definitely like everyone should be trying that, seeing what the progress from Google is like. And then, for when new like open source models come out, I don't try everything, you know, there are many different models. And if there's a new release, I don't know, from Quan, and I look at it, or it seems like it's a little bit better, you know, I don't think it's going to change anything in my understanding of the world. So I'm probably not going to spend much time on that. So that's the kind of probably frame I have, is that if you feel like does it like materially shift your understanding or not? And if the answer is you think probably not, then you can skip that one. But if it's something that feels different, then you should definitely spend time with it.
Sora definitely did that for me. Sora was the first time I was like, wow, for content creation, this is going to change the game. And what sort of features or what sort of use cases would you like AI to solve in the next few years? Where do you want it to go? Think blue sky thinking for your answer.
Yeah, it's very hard to kind of calibrate your expectations in terms of what's possible. So maybe I'll kind of start relatively small, as I think one kind of whole category of things is that the lab's not, I think, thinking about too much about the more boring things in day-to-day corporate work, such as just like creating PowerPoint files and Excels and things like that, and just working with documents and I don't know, filling in forms and all the custom applications. It's not like they're not doing it, but it feels like really underinvested area in terms of their capability. Such as, you know, you'd think that Microsoft should just have a PowerPoint agent for years now. But like, where is that? They haven't done anything on that. But they should be like the most obvious thing they should be doing. I think Anthropic's probably the better one in terms of the kind of the PowerPoint Excel kind of direction. So they seem to be focusing on the verticals more. So that's the kind of the obvious area that feels like that should make a lot of progress. You know, as a side note, you might have seen there was a benchmark from OpenAI. They released something like GGP eval or something like that, where it's like how much of the human tasks that AIs can do. And it's interesting, on the one hand, like, you shouldn't take it too literally. They still had to separate it by task and really do the analysis task by task, so, which is not really how the real world works. You know, there are many tasks, or there's a lot of value that humans add that you can't really separate into individual tasks that are automatable. But that aside, in the other direction, I think there's also quite a lot of value just left on the table, just because then the quality of the final output is just not very good. So just as a simple thing, there's not any AI that can do a presentation that is like a consultant level presentation at all. Like, they're just very bad at not the quality of thinking necessarily, but just the quality of the output. So I've been a consultant before. You know, if I do anything like that, that will be terrible. So, and the consultants craft their presentations like very carefully. So that's the kind of thing that I think if they solve the visuals and make that a lot better, then you can see it like a massive uplift. But yeah, in terms of your broader question, in terms of what can solve, there's still, I don't know how much of an ambitious answer that is, but there's still like quite a lot of friction in terms of like you need to think about what you ask, how you ask, and like what kind of output it gives you and what you do with it, and like all of these things. And I think the future AI just should kind of take care of a lot more that kind of gray space around it. And I feel like that could shift things a lot. And that maybe sounds like a little bit boring, But I feel like you need a lot of intelligence, a lot of agentic behavior around it. And that way, humans can do a lot more with AI later. Whether we can get to like much more kind of AGI direction, I really don't know. And even if we don't, I feel like there's still a lot to go.
Yeah, AGI is a buzzword, and so is super intelligence. I think they're both hand in hand. I actually watched The Thinking Game on Amazon Prime. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't.
Oh, man, you need to see it. It's Demis Hassabis and the DeepMind team, and it's their journey from when Demis was a child to now.
Oh, wow.
Okay. It came out in 2024, but Demis was a chess master. And when he was really young, there's a video of him saying, when they ask him, why do you like chess? He says, it's just a great thinking game. And for a child to say that is just phenomenal. It's really good. It talks about, you know, the work that they're doing, Project Astra, I think, when they show videos or live videos to AI and ask it questions, it can identify what's real or not. So definitely watch that. It kind of ties into what you said about AI needing to understand me and you as a person. And I feel like you're trying to say that it should become more emotionally intelligent, because emotional intelligence is understanding you, how you think, how you feel. And that's moving more towards artificial consciousness, really. So it'd be interesting to see if that happens in the next, you know, 5-10 years. And I don't think anybody knows where we're heading in terms of what's the guaranteed outcome, but everyone's trying fast to just improve things as fast as possible, right? So if you could pick one use case that you would like to solve if you were working full-time on these AI tools in your lifetime, what would it be?
Yeah, this is, you see, like, I feel like I don't let myself, like, get too carried away, because, like, I don't know, if you kind of feel like, oh, in my lifetime, like, how far can it go? You know, there's this, the kind of direction, and it depends on how far we can go, is that up the kind of capability ladder. So there is the basic version of what I do already, something like ask GPT-5 of like, oh, about some question or like experiment I want to run or app I want to build, and just like get it to build something out, and then I go away and kind of maybe work with this. And you can push down that direction a lot more, such as, yeah, can it like go and like build an app, deploy it, test it. Even that is like actually quite far away. So there's still like quite a lot of friction around doing that. And then you can imagine it going further and kind of, I don't know, building it up, launching it and running it and getting user feedback and all of the things like that. And that feels like, again, two orders of magnitudes of like complexity beyond that and being autonomous. So I feel like the dimension that is the most exciting to me, and I'm agnostic how far we're going to get there. I think whatever we get is exciting, is just the ability for you to implement some kind of fleeting ideas that you have. I think that's really opening up the capabilities quite a bit. And I'll give you some examples, like even now, right? I was thinking, oh, maybe that could be an interesting experiment to run with, like to test language models on like that dimension. And for me to do something like that normally without any kind of AI help, I would probably have to spend like a couple of weeks just trying to think about the experiment setup with like how do I write code for this, how do I collect the data, like doing all of that. But I literally, when I was walking my dog, I just like recorded my thought and just sent it to GPT-5 Pro. Then when I came back, I had the whole outline ready and gave it to Codex and just like coded it up, and it's ready to go for me to run it and like process the data and so on, kind of all of that one go. And the substitute there is not like, I think that's the interesting dimension as well, about like human labor, right? that wouldn't have added any kind of employment, right? There's no way I'm hiring someone to do something like that. That's more kind of a fleeting thought and experiment. But it gives me so much more capability to do something like that, that it's it really adds something that just wouldn't have existed otherwise. And I think that's the, if you kind of pull at that thread, I think this is the dimension that's quite exciting, is that, yeah, like how far can you push it? Could it have run the whole experiment for me, come back to me with results, propose new experiments, maybe just gone off and done even more experiments that maybe I hadn't thought of, like pulled it together, I don't know, went and published it. I don't know what else is like meaningful and useful. But yeah, it feels like we're like people now who are quite proactive can probably do something like that. But for a lot of people, it's like a little bit too difficult just now.
Yeah, I'll be honest. I've not used Codex too much because one, I find it a little bit intimidating having to set my GitHub repo, etc. And I need a bit more time to figure it out. It's not as plug and play as, let's say, ChatGPT and Sora, right? You have to think about what you're doing. So I need to sit down properly for 5 to 10 hours and go through it.
Well, I'll give you one way to start, which is much easier than that, where you don't really need a GitHub repo or anything like that. So the only thing is like a little bit annoying is that you need to basically download it or like install it in a terminal, and you just go to Codex or Cloud Code is the same. It's not really any different. Just install it, Cloud Code or Codex, then in your terminal. Then you just need to log in, and basically you're in since that. And then the best use case that I like is that have some kind of data set, just like a CSV file that you just have on your desktop, and get it to analyze the data and visualize it for you. And it's like, this is so good. And don't bother with any like GitHub repos, like you don't need any of this. And just ask it to create like an HTML file with the visualizations, and it can decide on like exact packages and so on that they can use. You can use like Python and Plotly behind the scenes or something like that, and it'll be great. And honestly, like I do this all the time now, and quite often I'll be like, I'll have some boring tasks such as I've got I don't know 3 CSVs with some usage data for some apps, and then what I would do is just to say, pick up those 3 files, pull it together, you know, align it so, you know, you can combine it, merge between those 3 into 1 file, and then do some analysis and create visualizations. And then I just open the HTML file, just look at the visualizations, and I can kind of go from there. So it's not like I probably couldn't have done all of these analysis myself by hand. I probably could have done something else, such as like, I don't know, put it in Excel and kind of go from there. Like, you know, I can do it. It's so much easier now, and you don't really need any setup. It's really not hard to do at all.
Thanks a lot. I'll definitely try that. So I just click on Codex. I download it, put it in the terminal. So I open the command center on my laptop. I just type in terminal, right? And then I say, hey, here's a CSV. And you give it the folder location, right? So you say, here's a location, and then reference it and prompt it, right? Is that it?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. If you go to like Codex website or like Cloud Code website, it'll tell you how to install it. And you basically open the terminal and you just run the install command. So it'll just automatically get installed. You might need to like approve things. Then log in. Yeah. And then you either just say there's the file name is in this folder, or you can like drag it into the terminal as well. And then it will give you the reference as well. Yeah. And go from there. It's really much easier. I know it kind of looks like it's very sophisticated coding, like a terminal looks very complicated. But the only reason why it's actually complicated, why it looks intimidating, is because you are expected to know all of the commands of how to use the terminal. But now you don't need to, right? You can just ask Codex or ask Cloud Code, and you can just say, help me do this or that. And I've actually, I've had examples where I would like, I know on my Mac, I couldn't work out how to change one setting or something. And just like ask Cloud Code or Codex to do it for me. And I know you approve some things and it just does it. But you know, that's how very technical, knowledgeable people do it themselves, right? They would know all the commands, but now you don't need to. So, and beyond that, it's not really technical. You know, it's just like, it's just basically like you can just type things in. You can just talk to it.
Wow. So I could effectively say to Codex, to run my computer, right? I can say for all of the emails that come in, reply saying, hi, I'm Peter, I'll come back in an hour. Is that how it works?
With something like emails, you might need to connect further. So you probably need, that maybe gets a little bit trickier, such as like you might need to get an MCP server connected to your email account and you need to authorize. But anything kind of on your desktop, so like, for example, that's probably the easiest one. If you've got things in your like folders, then you can manage that. That's the easiest. Beyond that, if you want to go further and kind of connect to different applications, like a little bit trickier, but also like pretty doable as well.
That's amazing. I'm definitely going to try that as soon as possible. Then I'll hit you up on LinkedIn and let you know what I've done. Hopefully I don't become better than you. Then you have to interview me. okay. So let's move on to, I've got a lot of questions here. You're interested in the pricing of models and GPUs. Can you explain to everyone listening how AI actually works? So when I prompt on my screen, what happens? And how does this energy thing work?
Yeah, so at the basic level, the most common pattern is that someone else has the model that is running in their cloud. And there's another version that you might have a model that's running on your laptop. Now, that's rarer, and unless you definitely know that you have done that, which you need to put some effort in, like it really isn't running on your laptop unless you're using like Apple Intelligence or something like that, but like who does that? The basic way to think about it is that it just goes off in the cloud in a data center and it just gets processed there, and you get the response. Now there are many levels of complexity the way you can answer that, as such as like there's batching of different users. There's also the how long is the context, and is it, if you have a very long conversation, that it kind of sends all of this again to the GPU to the same model, and it processes it with all of the context that you've provided. So it kind of can get really complicated, but at the basic level, it's just pretty much the same way like any data center would. And you just send response there, you get response back, and that is it. But yeah, in terms of the GPUs and the pricing and the investments in that space, the reason why I look at it, the reason why I find it interesting, is that this is really showing us the future of where the models are going. And you can't be overly specific in terms of where the models are going, but you can at least kind of squint and imagine. So one thing that I kept kind of hearing maybe 6-8 months ago, that, oh, you know, is it all a plateau and we're kind of hitting some kind of ceiling, but it never felt right to me that you should kind of make these pronouncements at that point in time. And the reason for that is that we knew that there were loads and lots of investments that are going into GPUs and new data center buildouts and so on. And if you look at how much capacity that is coming in terms of what labs would have access to, you can see that it's like extra order of magnitude or some multiples of what they had so far that is still to go. That is literally just being built. It's not like, oh, you know, maybe we'll get it in 3 years' time. No, it's literally coming online. And there is a bit of a delay between the models that we get access to now. So, such as, for example, let's say like GPT-5, right? The data centers and the investments that had to be built to train this model, right? Depends on which kind of stage you look at. You know, the model needs to be trained and assessed and post-trained and so on for like 6-8 months. And so you kind of have to go to the beginning of this year is the latest when this model could have been start training, but probably like a few months before that, you need to set it up and so on. So the investment decisions for this model were probably like a year and a half, 2 years ago. So if you kind of trace it back, and there's this lag in terms of investments, the investments that we just, the GPUs that are going online now, this is what we're going to get in 2 years' time in terms of the models. Maybe not quite that bad, but still, there's this kind of lag that you have. So when we see this massive investments going in, you need to imagine that there's still so much more to come in terms of just the delayed capabilities that are being created. And one basic point is that if you look at the just GPU improvements that have been happening, they're pretty amazing as well, because if you look at the chip, which was really the workhorse of all of the AI so far, which is H100 from NVIDIA, it was actually first released in, I think, something like November 2022 or like October 2022 or something like that. So this is literally about the same time as ChatGPT was launching. So obviously they couldn't have, it takes like a couple of years to design a chip. So they obviously couldn't have designed it in a way that is like optimal for ChatGPT use. So if you kind of think about it in multiple dimensions of, A, we haven't had all of these investments come through. B, we didn't really even have the chips that were designed for, especially think about like reasoning models. Imagine like in 2021, having to think about designing a chip for reasoning models. Now, this wouldn't even make sense as a concept. So how can you even design something? So we've got all of these investments and capabilities that are at like technical infrastructure level that haven't yet filtered through to the actual model development and then the model consumption, that I find this to be a really interesting angle to look at and to see, like, you can kind of squint and imagine what else is there to come if we've got so much more to arrive as well. And then you hear all of these crazy investments by OpenAI or into OpenAI by Oracle and NVIDIA and now with AMD and others. And then it's your head starts spinning. It's like, how much more is there to come? And apparently OpenAI planning to announce something else soon. So yeah, like all of that sort of investment and drive, and also the delay in capability that we actually get, it makes you think how much more there is to go. And who knows, it might not work out and maybe we'll hit some kind of ceiling. But I feel like it's way too early to say that right now.
Yeah, it's extremely early days. There is an area called neuromorphic computing, which is where the hardware and software is in the same place, which a couple of my guests have mentioned. So AI is basically as close to human brain as possible. I don't know lots about it, but hopefully in the next few years, there'll be neuromorphic computing, which is more advanced apparently than transformers. And on to the last two questions now. So the second last question for me is, what does ethics and governance look like for AI? Because there's a lot of questions around how we deploy AI responsibly, which for me is sustainably and ethically. So the ethical and governance side is key. What do you do currently? And what do you think we should do?
Yeah, I think the important part for me there is that I don't think we should be like too clever about it. I think there's a tendency of people to overthink and imagine some kind of crazy scenarios of, I don't know, AI taking over and trying to guard for that and so on. There are some basic things that we should put in place, and then such as, you know, making sure that, I know, we don't send customers' data somewhere where we shouldn't, or let AI do something risky that we are not comfortable with. These are all kind of basic things that, like, they're not necessarily even AI specific, but maybe just kind of put those things into sharper focus more. So that these are the sort of things, as at least builders, we should focus on. And if you can't get past these points, then you just can't deploy it. It's not even. Even if you put kind of ethics aside, you just cannot put certain things into production if they just don't work well. And it being, I don't know, not performing to your customers' expectations is also part of it not working well. So you can think about the model quality in the general, or just the AI system quality in this more general sense. So I think it helps, thinking about it this way just helps to take some heat out of it and more removes that personal opinion about AI and so on. So if, for example, the image model, I know, flips out sometimes, it does something weird, like we just can't use that probably unless we're kind of comfortable with the performance. So that's really the fundamental part of it. Yeah, and beyond that, with labs and their developments, I think that is a lot trickier because they obviously deal with ever-accelerating capability. You also never quite know whether we've been looking at the models in the right way. And actually, what always kind of I have at the back of my mind is that, could you just like prompt the model in like completely different way and actually just it behaves completely differently? And we've seen some examples of this with kind of jailbreaking techniques of just like a lot of filler characters or getting the models to overflow, like mixing languages, things like that. So that could be one direction, but there could be maybe something else that we haven't discovered. And it's very hard for humans to come up with these ideas because, we have our brains that think in a certain way. But if it's such a capable system with maybe a brain that's completely different to ours, then maybe it could be something else we're just missing. So that is a little bit worrying, but I like the approach that labs are taking right now. It's good to release things quickly so we can see what they are like. And so far, so good. Like I think a lot of the worries haven't really materialized. We'll get more spam and maybe slightly too polished messages at the higher volume and so on. But beyond that, I don't think we've seen anything like terrible happen, despite a lot of the predictions in that space.
Yeah, you make some really important points. So on the one hand, you have the developers of the tools, then you also have the users of the tools. For me personally, I've seen a lot of deep fakes and videos being created of people who passed away. So there was a video of Stephen Hawking going down a skateboarding ramp, and I can see maybe some bad actors using these tools in bad ways, and there are some guardrails around it. For example, in the USA, people can't use these tools to develop revenge porn and things like that, which is really good. So I feel like there's going to be maybe a lot of bad actors creating bad content, but the good thing is with these companies is they're adding in watermarks so we can trace things back. So that's also a good point. On to the last point now is, I always ask the person who I'm interviewing to ask a question to the audience. So it can obviously be about anything that you're interested in with AI, but it needs to be thought-provoking, really. The audience has to comment in YouTube or just ask their friends the question and get an answer from them, or comment on the post on LinkedIn, whatever it may be. So what's that question from you?
I'm always curious how are people starting to use these tools, and what are they kind of getting out of it and not getting out of it. So I'm really just curious to see kind of what's the one thing that you have done with AI that you haven't heard anyone else do. And I feel like there must be hundreds of things that people have done that I haven't even thought of. So I would be super curious to see what people answer.
That's a really good question. My answer is, I was using AI to reverse engineer pictures of things just for fun. So if I put in a picture of my dog, for example, I ask it to describe the prompt I would need to make that picture. And then what I would do is I call it prompt iterations to generate the outcome. So I give it the image back of the image that I gave back from the prompt and say improve the prompt to make it closer to the original image. And then this sort of infinite cycle until it gets it as close as possible. I'm sure in Codex you could probably do that, let's say, a million times within a few days and get a perfect prompt for the image that you want. Obviously now you have JSON, and back when I did these, I didn't know about the JSON formats that can make the best images, but maybe if I tried it now, it'd be good. So that's my one. So let's hear what everyone has to say in the comments. And if you want to message Peter, I'm sure that you you know where to find him on LinkedIn, etc. So yeah, I just want to say thanks for the conversation. It's been great. It's been nice and free-flowing, and I'm looking forward to seeing what you do next in the next 12 months with your career, for sure.
Yeah, brilliant. Thanks for having me. Really enjoyed our conversation.